I'm Chris Wood.
And Chris, can you tell me a bit more about your involvement with Ashton Court Mansion, how you came to be here and what your position was?
Well, originally I started with the council many years ago, back in the 70s, I think it was about 1978 or something like that, as a pool attendant. And gradually sort of worked my way within the sort of leisure services or leisure department at the time into various different jobs. Eventually, at the age of about sort of 23, I think I was, I became an operations manager, and which meant I had an area to look after, so swimming pools, sports centres. And Ashton Court actually came into my area then. So I didn't actually have any on-site workings with Ashton Court at that time. I sort of visited the place and made sure it was running okay and all the rest of it. And we had a separate, we had another manager here and a catering company. So I didn't have too much input into that. The council went through a big shake-up again back in about 1989, something like that, where they're trying to save money and God knows what else, and there's lots of stress and pressure on everything. I left and went to America, and I came back about a year later, and things have sort of settled down, and they wanted someone really to come in here into Ashton Court, into the mansion, and really give it a kick, because it would sort of been just floating along and no one really doing much with it. So I applied for a job and managed to get it, fortunately, after sort of several days of interviews or whatever, and was actually based down here then, rather than actually having an area. So a few months after that, I actually moved in here into the flat upstairs, and then that became my life really then for about the next 15 years, so from about the end of 1989, I suppose.
And what were your job responsibilities?
I was a manager and housekeeper, because the thing about the mansion is that you can't, it's not just a business, it's a house, it's a working house. You feel as if you have to feel part of it. So everything is about this place, is actually a developing, it has a living, breathing soul to it. So it's a 24-hour job of absolutely everything. So you run it as a commercial business. And one of my first jobs was to sort of increase the sort of popularity of it, I suppose. So back in the 80s, we didn't have the internet and all that sort of stuff. So it was literally sort of door knocking, going around people's houses and delivering leaflets and putting adverts out in the Evening Post with which little bit of money we had, and everything we possibly could do, you know, taking lots of photographs and showing the potential. And gradually we sort of, over a period of about sort of 2 or 3 years, increased the number of sort of functions we were doing. I think when I came here, we were doing about 120, 130 functions a year. By the time I left back in, I think it was 2004, and we went up to that level fairly quickly. Within 2 or 3 years, we'd gone from 150 to about 300. So we'd sort of doubled the capacity. And that was just by using better, you know, getting more people to know the place and making it actually look nice, you know, rather than sort of the plastic horrible chairs we had in before. I replaced the chairs and showed people actually what the potential was and got out to commercial businesses. You know, people were thinking of sort of, in those days, sort of having functions in town, you know, in hotels and things, rather than sort of coming to a nice place like this. We had, you know, originally here, there were things like the Rotary Club and stuff like that. There were just little conferences, internal stuff.
And what other capital improvements did you make to the building?
Very, very, very little capital stuff. That was the main problem that the council had, that there was very little actual capital money that could be spent on it. We had an annual budget, and we sort of zero-based that every year. Really, we had, obviously there was the council's way of functioning was to increase it by inflation. So you might have a 4% rise, which you would have to do sort of on your room hire. But no one ever came along and said, there's 200,000, there's £1 million to do a particular thing. So it was little bits and pieces that you could scrape together. You know, so I had a maintenance budget of sort of £15,000 a year or something. And then the city valuers also had a budget today, say, to painting and decorating. So there's never an you know, no one ever actually got together and said, there's a big lump of sum, you know, money, we can go and replace a floor. It was kind of reactive in that respect. But then we kept on top of things like, obviously, carpets and internal painting and stuff that we could do, the small bits and pieces we could do with the money we had.
And tell me about the chandeliers and the paintings that you sourced.
Well, again, I mean, some of the stuff was obviously done in the 70s, and it was done with the best of intentions, you know, with the stuff that was around at that time. And where I could, you know, I tried to make the place look a bit more sort of homely. So these chandeliers here in the lounge we're in, they came from, I think it was a place in Birmingham somewhere, which I just happened to come across, and they were sort of all in pieces and everything. And we just, I've got them refurbished here, actually, by an electrical company that I knew. So put them all back together again, and we put them up. And various other bits and pieces as well, like the painting and stuff we did in here. All this was done by ourselves. But it was all kept in line with the original colour schemes that were here as well, because obviously it's a Grade One listed building.
And tell us about the paintings in the Great Hall, because people always ask us, who are the people in the portraits when you walk in the door?
Well, there's various paintings around, actually. None of them were, well, there were various ones that were original in here, which we had on loan from the museum. So you had Greville and Dame Emily in here, and various other ones. Some of the other paintings around were copies. But they were copies of the original paintings that were here. Probably 80% of them were. And a friend of mine, actually, who was very interested in art, actually went to London and went to the portrait gallery there and did some research and actually went off and got these copied in China. So I think for the sum of about £5,000 or whatever it was, we had these looked magnificent sort of paintings around the place where we just had bare walls before.
Can you tell me what happened to the profit that was made from the mansion during the time, and whether that was reinvested back into the house or not?
Well, that is a difficult one to say, because as any accountant will tell you, there's different ways of looking at profit. You know, a good accountant will ask you, you know, say, what do you want one and one to be? And that was the problem here, that there was just so many different ways of looking at the income and expenditure that were coming in and going out. The way it was set up is that we had an annual budget from the council, and we managed and controlled basically this site. We had a private caterer on site here, ACM Catering, which were very, very good. I mean, they came in after the original caterers here went bust and sort of stepped up to the post there and gradually sort of built up their company. And again, they were sort of part of the family. But originally they had, the setup with the council was that the council took 50% of their profit, their net profit after their expenses. And later on that was then changed because the council wanted more money, so there was a 60-40 split done. The problem from the catering company desperately wanted to actually put more money into the council. But the council would not ever give them a longer contract than a year. So every single year they had to reapply for a new contract. Two or three times during this sort of 25-year period or whatever that I think they were here, they had a two-year or a three-year extension, and that was it. But the council would never make a commitment to say, look, if we give you a 20-year contract, will you give us this amount? Because they would have gladly jumped over hurdles to do that, because it was in their interest to open up more of the building to get more money back in. So several times we went to the council, you know, my seniors, and said, can we do this? And several times the answer was no. But so going back to the sort of the profit margins involved, it was very difficult to actually look at that, because obviously the catering company was making a profit out of it. They were paying for their staff. We had an annual budget. And the problem with it was that if we actually made a profit, as in the council, we would then get our budget cut for the next year. That's the way it works. You know, central government would not give the council. So we tried our best to, obviously, to make it actually balance. And we have ways of doing that.
Some of the events that you had here, can you tell me about some of your favourite events?
So many. I mean, obviously, we're doing 500 a year, you know, over 100 weddings a year. The place, as you look around now, is absolutely lovely, beautiful, sedate, as it should be, as a place like this, you know, in a fantastic landscape you've got here. But back in the 80s, it was in some occasions, it was like the Wild West. There were no barriers around the estate. And whilst 99% of the time it was a beautiful place for people to come and they could drive their cars onto the lawn and have, you know, teas and coffees and cakes out there and kick their footballs around, fantastic. in the evenings, it changed completely, and it would be like the Wild West out there sometimes. And we had occasions when there used to be clashes with sort of cars screaming up and down outside when you've got a really nice sort of wedding trying to get in here as well. So that was quite difficult to control. But the functions themselves, we had so many different ones that, you know, literally from weddings to bar mitzvahs to great big Indian weddings, with, you know, trying to get our caterers to supply various different types of Indian food. We had huge, great functions. We had one actually on the South Lawn out there where the Marquis took over almost the whole of the South Lawn for 1,200 people. And that was fun because we had to put satellite kitchens all the way around, and we'd never done anything that big before. The most we'd ever served was about sort of 200 to 300. We had the New Year's Eve parties here, which was 900 to 1,000 people, one love. So various different music systems and everything going right the way through the house with banging music going on to 4 in the morning. And you could literally then go from that to 2 days later having a really upmarket wedding. So it was just anything and everything that we could possibly do to make money and not destroy the house, really.
And what was it like living in the house?
Oh, well, that was fabulous. It was lovely. I mean, I have great memories of the place, but also very difficult because obviously you're on the job 24 hours a day. I had CCTV cameras around all over the place. And no matter how good as a manager you are, there's always things going wrong, you know. So I'd get phone calls at 10, 11 o'clock at night for, you know, we'd run out of a barrel of beer or something. And you wouldn't just leave it. You'd have to do something. So I'd go down to the local pub and borrow a barrel of beer or something, bring it back and get that set up. When I first moved in here, it was a very, very strange environment. The house almost, it was very, very cold. So it sounds strange, but a real bad feeling about the place. And there were so many different sort of things going on here. There'd be big thumps in the middle of the night and windows blowing open with no wind and all sorts of strange things happening. And probably for the first 6 months, I didn't sleep very well at all. I used to come down with bags under my eyes. It changed almost after about 6 months. It's almost like the house kind of takes you over, or it gels with you. And it does sound very weird. For me, as a sort of fairly scientific and black and white kind of person, to say that, but you do get this melding of, you know, of the place.
Did you ever see, or you've mentioned noises, but did you ever see anything in terms of the ghosts of Ashton Court?
I've never seen anything. Some of the staff here have. I had one lady resign because she saw a lady walk through the great hall behind her about 4 o'clock in the morning when she was doing the cleaning here. And she came in and resigned the next day. But no, I've never seen anything, but I've had a lot of things happen. I got thrown off a chair once upstairs in the flat because I had an office up there. I thought it was actually an earthquake. And so I came running downstairs only to find all the staff just sat in the refectory there having a cup of coffee waiting for the next service and saying, what's going on? You know, I thought it was a bloody earthquake. But it wasn't. It was just something that just dragged the chair from me upstairs. And once when I went on holiday, I came back 2 weeks later to find all the furniture sort of piled up in the middle of the room. You know, big oak cases and things like that, which were standing against the wall, had all sort of crashed into the centre of the room where there was a coffee table and everything was just sort of all piled in there. And no one else could get into the place. I was the only person who had the keys.
Is that the room that had the secret doorway in it?
No, this was actually in the living room itself, okay. Which is right at the front of the house. Yeah. So it's a big room. And another time, actually, I had a dark room up there as well, funny enough, which I didn't realise at the time that Lady Smythe was a very keen photographer as well. I used to do my, you know, in those days we didn't have digital photographs and things like that, so I used to do all my darkroom stuff, and a friend of mine was very good, well, half decent amateur photographer as well, so we used to share it. And I went on holiday again once, and he asked if he could use it, so he went up there, and I came back again about sort of 10 days later to find all the lights had been left on, the place stinky of chemicals and all the rest of it, and strings of, you know, film all hanging around. So I phoned him up and I asked him what had gone on, and he said, obviously I was only there for a couple of hours, I just put some rolls of film up, and then suddenly there's this almighty crash, and the whole ceiling just started vibrating. And there's like a thundering sound and vibrating ceiling. And he said, honestly, he said, I just left. I literally just ran down the stairs, slammed the doors, and that, I didn't go back.
Yeah. I don't blame
you. So it is strange, and, you know.
We used to hear footsteps overhead, actually.
Yeah.
And I kept saying, no, it's just the Rangers.
Well, the chap from the Evening Post actually stayed here once, up in the bell tower.
Brave.
And he heard lots of footsteps and things in the middle of the night.
They stopped for us about 3 months in, I think. We just kind of went, they're happy. They're happy with what we're doing. So I think that's...
I've had terrible dreams about this place recently.
Really?
Mm. Really, really bad.
Gosh.
Really bad. It was quite disconcerting coming down here.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
just really bad. Yeah.
Right.
Especially about the Long Gallery.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know why. Are you going to elaborate more about that, or is that something you don't want to talk about?
No, probably not.
Okay. Yeah.
No, it does sound weird coming from me when you actually say it. You know, just very, very strange.
No.
But dreams are dreams, you know.
Dreams are dreams, but there's a lot of... I think this place was a big part of your life, and it's going through a big... sense of uncertainty, and it does, as Liza Donahue, who is the artist here, said, it gets under your skin. The house gets under your skin.
Well, we used to say to people when they came here as staff, even before we interviewed them, we just showed them around before, you know, whatever it was, a receptionist or whatever it was, or a cleaner or anyone, we showed them around first of all to see if they would feel comfortable with the place. Because one of my other staff used to say, you became mansionized, you know. It's sort of, you have to belong to the place and it belongs to you.
Do you remember the mansion when it was opened, really, in the 70s, and what kind of events would have been on here?
No, I don't, I'm afraid, no. Yeah. No, so I didn't really sort of have much to do with the place, to be honest, until about 89. I did actually come down here in 78, 79 as a general assistant, but my responsibilities were sort of stacking chairs and things like that. I was only about 19, I think, at the time.
Yeah. No big memories of them.
No.
You mentioned when we talked before about how you wrote a report to the council and you had recommendations. Can you tell us a bit more about that and what happened subsequent to that?
Well, going back a little bit about sort of the mansion itself and where it sits in the estate and the council's view of things. I mean, the council obviously took a great... a leap of faith back in the sort of 60s or whatever and early 70s when they put all this money actually into the mansion to do something with it. Unfortunately, because of the political situation between the involvement of the recently formed Avon County Council and Bristol City Council, obviously that money was pulled out. And so you were left with the mansion that was only sort of half done, really. And when I came here, actually, you could still see where the lunch boxes had been put down from the builders, you know, where they'd almost told that day, you know, sorry, we're finishing, we're packing up. You know, so you had all these staircases and things all done, ready to go back up again and just left, basically. So, I mean, it was a great thing that the council did then, but they unfortunately didn't follow through. The way the council has worked in the so many years, the mansion was passed from pillar to post, basically. So it went from, I think, the Parks Department... where their view was about the park, obviously, the estate. Then it went to Leisure Services, or was it Recreation at the time? Yeah, Indoor Recreation. The people in charge of that were more to do with sort of sports centres, swimming pools, that sort of thing. So they wanted to look at the leisure side of it. At one stage, then, it was then passed to museums. So they had then, of course, there was a museum-type report done. So the bias was on that sort of thing. So they spent several thousands of pounds actually coming up for this consultancy that recommended this place was going to become an interactive museum, which is, museums don't make money anyway. You know, no one wants to pay to go into a museum. They've tried that. So that was an absolute waste of time. But the problem is that no one's ever actually looked at this place and said that Ashton Court Mansion is the focus. It's always been the estate is the focus and the house is just there. So when I looked at it, I tried my hardest. When we were looking at this whole thing again, we were looking at getting lottery funding. I tried my hardest to keep this all together. unfortunately, eventually it fell on deaf ears because it was deemed so difficult to actually do the mansion and much easier to do the estate. So the things were split off and we were just sort of left by ourselves here. The council then wanted to actually then go out and get another caterer, not because they were a bad caterer, but they were under pressure because they hadn't actually got another caterer. It had never gone out to tender effectively. They'd just been actually giving these yearly contracts. Instead of actually biting the bullet at the time and actually saying, what can we do about it? What they did was just try and replace the caterer. But they only went half the way, unfortunately, because they didn't realise that what we actually did as the management team of the house. So they put a caterer in here, but then left the mansion really with no one actually looking after it. It's such a shame because when I looked at this originally, what I wanted to do was actually put together to keep the council in charge of it still, effectively, but to try and get the money that we could make out of it, which I knew we could make out of it, and the private catering companies knew we could make out of it, but keep that so we had it in one lump sum every year so we could then eventually build it up to then go out and get like-for-like lottery funding. So I wanted to form a charitable organisation and a commercial company with inextricable links that so work together. So the charitable organisation, the trust, had a responsibility for marketing and building the company up and bringing people on board that would actually have the money and the nous to actually do something with the place. The commercial company could then sit on the, you know, the wad of money and actually do something with it. And I put that report in to the council. And again, it went out to various, you know, this was a, they didn't ask me specifically for it. I just did this off my own bat. This went out to everyone, all in sundry, and they actually didn't get anyone. They had lots of interest, but they didn't have anyone that actually came in with a physical report that says, this is how we're actually going to it. Because, you know, the devil's always in the detail. You know, it's great talking about things, but it's not until you get down to the detail, like Brexit. You know, it seems like a great idea on the back of a fag packet, but it's when you actually start doing it and looking at the finances and how you're actually going to do this and how long it's going to take. I know my report just literally sat on someone's desk and they came back to me about a week after this thing was due to be opened and said, unfortunately, no one else actually put a bid in for it. So we need to go out to retender again. But that's the last I heard of it, right?
And what would you like to see happen to the house in the future?
Well, I just want to see it as a proper house again, a working environment, actually being used. You know, you've got a house here that's been here since Saxon times, not as it is obviously now. There's a huge amount of history here, and it should be the focal point of the estate, not the other way around. You know, this was the focal point of the estate originally. Lots of people come up here, but not lots of people use it. You know, in the past, we used to have... You know, we used to have guided tours on a Sunday, 5 or 6 times a year. We had, you know, lots of people coming to functions here. So many people have fantastic memories of coming to dinner, dances and balls and getting married here and all sorts of things, you know. And that's just recent times. This place dates back, it was part of our heritage, part of our history. So I want to see it actually look like a proper house again, not some derelict, shabby old place that should be knocked down, you know.